in smoke and fire. He saw a battalion of ships crossing the narrow strait. He saw the beginning of a war.
"What do you see?" asked Alten Trangzin.
The white-haired seer tilted his head to the sky, exposing long, jagged scars running down the sides of his pale neck. He uttered a harsh, cackling laugh.
"He's gone," he said. "He's really gone."
Alten's fingers tightened on the seer's shoulder. The seer's eyes flew open. Behind thin eyelids there was nothing but white. No pupils, no irises, no spot of color. Only a pale mountain landscape, like freshly fallen snow, like nothingness itself.
"There has been a hexagram."
"Tell me,"
Alten said. The seer turned to face him.
"I see the truth of three things. One, we stand on the verge of war. This we've known,"
Alten said, but the seer cut him off.
"Two, we have an enemy whom we love."
Alten stiffened.
"Three, Tyr is lost."
Alten swallowed hard.
"What does that mean?"
The seer took his hand, brought it to his lips and kissed it.
"I have seen the end of things," he said. "The shape of the world has changed. The gods now walk in men as they have not for a long, long time. Tyr will not return. The bizarre children answer to you now, and you alone."
Alten exhaled slowly. He felt a tremendous sense of both grief and relief. He had no commander. No. He was the commander.
"Tyr cannot stop me now," he thought.
Tyr's death was felt by the gatekeeper himself, who had lingered all these years, not quite dead but not quite alive, ensconced in the shell of a mortal but not mortal himself. The gatekeeper was broken and confused, and he had forgotten much of who he was. But one thing he would never forget was the stain of the vipress's venom. The gatekeeper felt her ancient power dissipate into the void that both separated them and brought them together. And he raised his head to the sky and knew that an enemy had returned. It was felt by the young apprentice at Synegard, who meditated alone when her classmate slept, who frowned at the disturbance she felt acutely but did not understand, who wondered, as she constantly did, what would happen if she disobeyed her master, swallowed the poppy seed, and traversed to commune again with the gods. If she did more than commune, if she pulled one back down with her. For although she was forbidden from calling the phoenix, that did not stop the phoenix from calling upon her.
"Soon," whispered the phoenix in her sleep, "soon you will call on me for my power, and when the time comes, you will not be able to resist. Soon you will ignore the warnings of the woman and the gatekeeper and fall into my fiery embrace. I can make you great. I can make you a legend."
She tried to resist. She tried to empty her mind, like Jiang had taught her. She tried to clear the anger and the fire from her head. She found that she couldn't. She found that she didn't want to. On the first day of the seventh month, another border skirmish erupted between the 18th Battalion of the Federation Armed Forces and the Nikara Patrol in Horse Province bordering the hinterlands to the north. After 6 hours of combat, the parties reached a ceasefire. They passed the night in an uneasy truce. On the second day, a Federation soldier did not report for morning patrol. After a thorough search of the camp, the Federation general at the border city of Muradin demanded the Nikara general open the gates of his camp to be searched. The Nikara general refused. On the third day, Emperor Ryohai of the Federation of Mugen issued by courier pigeon a formal demand to the Empress Su Daji for the return of his soldier at Muriden. The Empress called the 12 warlords to her throne at Sinigard and deliberated for 72 hours. On the 6th day, the Empress formally replied that Ryohai could go fuck himself. On the 7th day, the Federation of Mugen declared war on the Empire of Nikan. Across the Longbow Island, women wept tears of joy and purchased likenesses of Emperor Ryohai to hang in their homes. Men enlisted to serve in the reserve forces, and children ran in the streets screaming with the celebratory bloodlust of a nation at war. On the 8th day, a battalion of Federation soldiers landed at the port of Muriden and decimated the city. When resisted by province militia, they ordered that all the males in Muriden, children and babies included, be rounded up and shot. The women were spared only by the Federation army's haste to move inland. The battalion looted the villages as it went, seized grain and transport animals for their own. What they could not take with them, they killed. They needed no supply lines. They took from the land as they traveled. They marched across the heartland on a warpath to the capital. On the 13th day, a courier eagle reached the office of Jima Lain at the academy. It read simply, "Horse Province has fallen. Mugen comes for Sinigard."
"It's sort of exciting, really," Kitai said.
"Yes," said Rin. "We're about to be invaded by our centuries-old enemy after they breached a peace treaty that has maintained a fragile geopolitical stability for 2 decades. So very exciting."
"At least now we know we have job security," said Kitai. "Everyone wants more soldiers."
"Could you be a little less glib about this?"
"Could you be less depressing?"
"Could we move a bit faster?"
asked the magistrate.
Rin and Kitai glanced at each other. Both of them would rather have been doing anything other than aiding the civilian evacuation effort. Since Sinigard was too far north for comfort, the Empire's bureaucracy was moving to a wartime capital in the city of Golden Nice to the south. By the time the Federation battalion arrived, Sinigard would be nothing but a ghost city. A city of soldiers. In theory, this meant that Rin and Kitai had the incredibly important job of ensuring that the central leadership of the Empire survived, even if the capital didn't. In practice, this meant dealing with very fat, very annoying city bureaucrats. Kitai tried to hoist the last crate up into the wagon and promptly staggered under the weight.
"What's in this?"
he demanded, wobbling as he tried to balance the crate on his hip. Rin hastily reached down and helped Kitai ease the crate up onto the wagon, which was already teetering from the weight of the magistrate's many possessions.
"My teapots,"
said the magistrate.
"See how I marked the side? Careful not to let it tilt."
"Your teapots," Kitai repeated incredulously. "Your teapots are a priority right now."
"They were a gift to my father from the Dragon Emperor. May his soul rest in peace."
The magistrate surveyed the top-heavy wagon.
"Oh, that reminds me. Don't forget the vase on the patio."
He looked imploringly at Rin. She was dazed from the afternoon heat, exhausted from hours of packing the magistrate's entire estate into several ill-prepared moving vehicles. She noticed in her stupor that the magistrate's jowls quivered hilariously when he spoke. Under different circumstances, she might have pointed that out to Kitai. Under different circumstances, Kitai might have laughed. The magistrate gestured again to the vase.
"Be careful with that, will you? It's as old as the Red Emperor. You might want to strap it down to the back of the wagon."
Rin stared at him in disbelief.
"Sir?"
Kitai asked. The magistrate turned to look at him.
"What?"
With a grunt, Kitai raised the crate over his head and flung it to the ground. It landed on the dirt with a hard thud. Not the tremendous crash Rin had rather been hoping for. The wooden lid of the crate popped off. Out rolled several very nice porcelain teapots, glazed with a lovely flower pattern. Despite their tumble, they looked unbroken. Then Kitai took to them with a slab of wood. When he was done smashing them, he pushed his wiry curls out of his face and whirled on the sweating magistrate, who cringed in his seat as if afraid Kitai might start smashing at him, too.
"We are at war," Kitai said. "And you are being evacuated because, for God's know what reason, you've been deemed important to this country's survival. So do your job. Reassure your people. Help us maintain order. Do not pack your fucking teapots."
Within days, the academy was transformed from a campus to a military encampment. The grounds were overrun with green-clad soldiers from the 8th Division of the nearby Ram Province, and the students were absorbed into their number. The militia soldiers were a stoic, curt crowd. They took on the academy students begrudgingly, all the while making it very clear that they thought the students had no place in the war.
"It's a superiority issue," Kitai speculated later. "Most of the soldiers were never at Synegard. It's like being told to work with someone who in 3 years would have been your superior officer, even though you have a decade of combat experience on them."
"They don't have combat experience either," said Rin. "We've fought no wars in the last 2 decades. They know less of what they're doing than we do."
Kitai couldn't argue with that. At least the arrival of the 8th Division meant the return of Raban, who was tasked with evacuating the first-year students out of the city, along with the civilians.
"But I want to fight,"
protested a student who barely came up to Rin's shoulder.
"Fat lot of good you'll do," Raban answered.
The first year stuck out his chin.
"Synegard is my home. I'll defend it. I'm not a little kid. I don't have to be herded out like all those terrified women and children." "You are defending Synegard. You're protecting its inhabitants. All those women and children? You're in charge of their safety. Your job is to make sure they get to the mountain pass. That's quite a serious task."
Raban caught Rin's eye as he shepherded the first years out of the main gate.
"I'm scared some of the younger ones are going to sneak back in," he told her quietly.
"You've got to admire them," said Rin. "Their city's about to be invaded and their first thought is to defend it."
"They're being stupid," said Raban.
He spoke with none of his usual patience. He looked exhausted.
"This is not the time for heroism. This is war. If they stay, they're dead."
Escape plans were made for the students. In case the city fell, they were to flee down the little-known ravine on the other side of the valley, to join the rest of the civilians in a mountain hideout where they couldn't be reached by the Federation battalions. This plan did not include the masters.
"Jima doesn't think we can win," said Kitai. "She and the faculty are going to go down with the school."
"Jima's just being cautious," said Raban, trying to lift their spirits. "Sun Tzu said to plan for every contingency, right? Sun Tzu also said that when you cross a river, you should burn the bridges so that your army can't entertain thoughts of retreating," said Kitai. "This sounds a lot like retreating to me."
"Prudence is different from cowardice," said Raban.
"And besides, Sun Tzu also wrote that you should never attack a cornered foe. They'll fight harder than any man thinks possible. Because a cornered enemy has nothing to lose."
The day seemed to both stretch for an eternity and disappear before anything could get done. Rin had the uncomfortable sense that they were just waiting around for the enemy to land on their front porch. At the same time, she felt frantically underprepared, as if battle preparations were not being done quickly enough.
"I wonder what a Federation soldier looks like,"
Kitai said as they descended the mountain to pick up sharpened weapons from the armory.
"They have arms and legs, I'm guessing. Maybe even a head."
"No, I mean, what do they look like?"
Kitai asked.
"Like Nikata? All of the Federation came from the Eastern Continent. They're not like Hesperians, so they must look somewhat normal."
Rin couldn't see why this was relevant. "Does it matter?"
"Don't you want to see the face of the enemy?"
Kitai asked.
"No, I don't," she said. "Because then I might think they're human. And they're not human. We're talking about the people who gave opium to toddlers the last time they invaded. The people who massacred Spear."
"Maybe they're more human than we realize,"
said Kit Tai. Has anyone ever stopped to ask what the Federation want? Why is it that they must fight us? Because they're crammed on that tiny island and they think Nikon should be theirs. Because they fought us before and they almost won, Rin said curtly. What does it matter? They're coming and we're staying, and at the end of the day, whoever is alive is the side that wins. War doesn't determine who's right. War determines who remains.
All classes at Synegard ceased to meet. The masters resumed positions they had retired from decades ago. Irja took over strategic command of the Synegardian reserve forces. Enro and her apprentices returned to the city's central hospital to set up a triage center. Jima assumed martial command over the city, a position she shared with the Ram Warlord. This involved, in parts, shouting at city officials and at obstinate squadron leaders. The outlook was grim. The 8th Division was 3,000 men strong, hardly enough to take on the reported invading force of 10,000. The Ram Warlord had sent for reinforcements from the 3rd Division, which was returning from patrol up north by the hinterlands, but the 3rd was unlikely to arrive before the Federation did. Jiang was rarely available. He was always either in Jima's office going over contingency plans with Irja, or not on campus at all. When Rin finally managed to track him down, he seemed hurried and impatient. She had to run to keep up with him on his way down the steps.
We're putting lessons on hiatus, he said. I'm sure you've noticed there's no time for that now. I can't devote the time to train you properly.
He made to brush past her, but she grabbed his sleeve.
Master, I wanted to ask, what if we called the gods? I mean, against the Federation.
What are you talking about?
He seemed faintly aghast.
Now is hardly the time for this.
Surely there are battle applications to what we've been studying, she pressed.
We've been studying how to consult the gods, he said. Not how to bring them back down to Earth.
But they could help us fight.
What? No. No!
He flapped his hands, growing visibly agitated as he spoke.
Have you not listened to a word I've said these past 2 years? I told you, the gods are not weapons you can just dust off and use. The gods won't be summoned into battle.
That's not true, she said. I've read the reports from the Red Emperor's crusades. I know the monks summoned gods against him. And the tribes of the hinterlands—
The hinterlanders consult the gods for healing. They seek guidance and enlightenment,
Zhang interrupted.
They do not call the gods down onto Earth, because they know better. Every war we've fought with the aid of the gods, we've won at a terrible consequence. There is a price. There is always a price.
Then what's the point? She snapped. Why learn lore at all?
His expression then was terrible. He looked as he had that day Sunza the pig was slaughtered, when she told him she wanted to pledge strategy. He looked wounded. Betrayed. The point of every lesson does not have to be to destroy, he said. I taught you lore to help you find balance. I taught you so that you would understand how the universe is more than what we perceive. I didn't teach you so that you could weaponize it.
The gods—
The gods will not be used at our beck and call. The gods are so far out of our realm of understanding that any attempt to weaponize them can only end in disaster.
What about the phoenix? Zhang stopped walking.
Oh no. Oh no, no, no.
The god of the Spearlies, said Rin. Each time it has been called, it has answered. If we could just—
Zhang looked pained.
You know what happened to the Spearlies.
But they were channeling fire long before the Second Poppy War. They practiced shamanism for centuries. The power—
The power would consume you, Zhang said harshly. That's what fire does. Why do you think the Spearlies never won back their freedom? You'd think a race like that wouldn't have remained subordinate for long. They would have conquered all of Nikon, if their power were sustainable. How come they never revolted against the Empire? The fire killed them, Rin, just as it empowered them. It drove them mad, It robbed them of their ability to think for themselves, until all they knew to do was fight and destroy as they had been ordered. The Spearleys were obsessed with their own power, and as long as the Emperor gave them free license to run rampant with their bloodlust, there was very little they cared about. The Spearleys were collectively deluded. They called the fire, yes, but they are hardly worth emulating. The Red Emperor was cruel and ruthless, but even he had the good sense never to train shamans in his militia, outside of the Spearleys. Treating the gods as weapons only ever spells death.
We're at war! We might die anyway! So maybe calling the gods gives us a fighting chance. What's the worst that could happen?
You're so young, he said softly. You have no idea.
After that, Rin saw neither hide nor hair of Jiang on campus at all. Rin knew he was deliberately avoiding her, as he had before her trials, as he did whenever he didn't want to have a conversation. She found this incredibly frustrating.
You're so young. That was even more frustrating. She wasn't so young that she didn't know her country was at war. Not so young that she hadn't been tasked to defend it.
Children ceased to be children when you put a sword in their hands. When you taught them to fight a war, then you armed them and put them on the front lines. They were not children anymore. They were soldiers. Synegard's time was running out. Scouts reported daily that the Federation force was almost on their doorstep. Rin couldn't sleep, though she desperately needed to. Each time she closed her eyes, anxiety crushed her like an avalanche. During the day, her head swam with exhaustion and her eyes burned, yet she could not calm herself enough to rest. She tried meditating, but terror plagued her mind. Her heart raced and her breath contracted with fear. At night, when she lay alone in the darkness, she heard over and over the call of the phoenix. It plagued her dreams, whispered seductively to her from the other realm. The temptation was so great that it nearly drove her mad.
I will keep you sane,
Jiang had promised. But he had not kept her sane. He had shown her a great power, a tantalizingly wonderful power strong enough to protect her city and country, and then he had forbidden her from accessing it. Rin obeyed, because he was her master. And the allegiance between master and apprentice still meant something, even in times of war. But that didn't stop her from going into his garden when she knew he was not on campus, and shoving several handfuls of poppy seeds in her front pocket. Chapter 11 When the main column of the Federation Armed Forces marched on Synegard, they did not attempt to conceal their arrival. They did not need to. Synegard knew already that they were coming, and the terror the Federation inflicted gave them a far greater strategic advantage than the element of surprise. They advanced in three columns, marching from every direction but the west, where Synegard was backed by the Wudong Mountains. They forged forward with massive crimson banners flying overhead, illuminated by raised torches. For Ryohai, the banners read. For the Emperor. In his Principles of War, the great military theorist Sun Tzu had warned against attacking an enemy that occupied the higher ground. The target above held the advantage of surveillance and would not need to tire out their troops by climbing uphill. The Federation invasion strategy was a giant fuck you to Sun Tzu. To storm Synegard from higher ground would have required a detour up the Wudong Mountains, which would have delayed the Federation assault by almost an entire week. The Federation would not give Synegard a week. The Federation had the weapons and the numbers to take Synegard from below. From her vantage point, high on the southern city wall, Rin watched the Federation force approach like a great fiery snake, winding its way through the valley, encircling Synegard to crush and swallow it. She saw it coming, and she trembled.
I want to hide.
I want someone to tell me I'm going to be safe, that this is just a joke, a bad dream.
In that moment, she realized that all this time she had been playing at being a soldier, playing at bravery. But now, on the eve of the battle, she could not pretend anymore. Fear bubbled in the back of her throat, so thick and tangible that she almost choked on it. Fear made her fingers tremble violently so that she almost dropped her sword. Fear made her forget how to breathe. She had to force air into her lungs, close her eyes, and count to herself as she inhaled and exhaled. Fear made her dizzy and nauseated, made her want to vomit over the side of the wall. "It's just a physiological reaction," she told herself. "It's just in your mind. You can control it. You can make it go away." They had gone over this in training. They had been warned about this feeling. They were taught to control their fear, turn it to their advantage, use their adrenaline to remain alert, to ward off fatigue. But a few days of training could not negate what her body instinctively felt, which was the imminent truth that she was going to bleed. She was going to hurt, and she was most likely going to die. When had she last been this scared? Had she felt this paralysis, this numbing dread, before she stepped into the ring with Najah 2 years ago? No, she had been angry then, and proud. She had thought she was invincible. She had been looking forward to the fight, anticipating the bloodlust. That felt stupid now. So, so stupid. War was not a game, where one fought for honor and admiration, where masters would keep her from sustaining any real harm. War was a nightmare. She wanted to cry. She wanted to scream and hide behind someone, behind one of the soldiers. Wanted to whimper.
"I am scared. I want to wake up from this dream. Please save me."
But no one was coming for her. No one was going to save her. There was no waking up.
"Are you all right?" Kitai asked.
"No," she said, trembling. Her voice was a frightened squeak. "I'm scared. Kitai, we're going to die."
"No, we're not," Kitai said fiercely. "We're going to win, and we are going to live."
"You've done the math, too."
They were outnumbered 3-1.
"Victory is not possible."
"You have to believe it is."
Kitai's fingers were clenched so tightly around his sword hilt that they had turned white.
"The third will get here in time. You have to tell yourself that's true."
Rin swallowed hard and nodded. "You were not trained to snivel and cower," she told herself. The girl from Tikani, the escaped bride who had never seen a city, would have been scared. The girl from Tikani was gone. She was a third-year apprentice of the academy at Sinigard. She was a soldier of the 8th Division. And she was trained to fight. And she was not alone. She had poppy seeds in her pocket. She had a god on her side.
"Tell me when,"
Kitai said. He was poised with his sword over the rope that constrained a booby trap they had set to defend the outer perimeter. Kitai had designed this trap. He would unleash it just as soon as the enemy was within range. They were so close she could see the firelight flickering over their faces. Kitai's hand trembled.
"Not yet,"
she whispered. The first of the Federation battalion crossed the boundary.
"Now!"
Kitai slashed at the rope. A rolling avalanche of logs was freed from its breaking point, pulled down by gravity to bowl straight through the main advancing force. The logs rolled chaotically, shattered limbs and crushed bone with a noise like thunder that went on and on. For a moment the rumbling of carnage was so great, Rin thought they might have won the battle before it started. Might have seriously crippled the advancing force. Kitai whooped hysterically over the clamor, clutching Rin to keep from falling over as the gates themselves shook. But when the roar of the logs died down, The invaders continued to advance into Sinigard to the steady beat of war drums. A tier above Rin and Kitai, standing at the highest precipices of the south gate, the archers loosed a round of arrows. Most clattered uselessly against raised shields. Some found their way through the cracks, embedded their heads in the unguarded fleshy parts of soldiers' necks. But the heavily armored Federation soldiers simply marched over the bodies of their fallen comrades, continuing their relentless assault toward the city gates. The squadron leader shouted for another round of arrows. It was close to pointless. There were far more soldiers than there were arrows. Sinigard's outer defense was flimsy at best. Each of Kitai's booby traps had been sprung, and though all but one went off beautifully, they were not enough to even dent the enemy ranks. There was nothing to do but wait. Wait until the gate was broken, until there was a tremendous crash. Then the signal gongs were ringing, screaming to all who didn't already know that the Federation had breached the walls. The Federation was in Sinigard. They marched to the cacophony of cannon fire and rockets, bombarding Sinigard's outer defenses with their siege breakers. The gate buckled and broke under the strain. They poured through like a swarm of ants, like a cloud of hornets, unstoppable and infinite, overwhelming in number. "We can't win!" Rin stood in a daze of despair, sword hanging by her side. What difference would it make if she fought back? It might stay her death sentence by a few seconds, maybe minutes, but at the end of the night she would be dead, her body broken and bloody on the ground, and nothing would matter. This battle wasn't like the ones in the legends, where numbers didn't matter, where a handful of warriors like the Trifecta could flatten an entire legion. It didn't matter how good their techniques were. It mattered how the numbers balanced, and the Sinigardians were so badly outnumbered. Rin's heart sank as she watched the armored troops advance into the city, rows and columns stretching into infinity. "I'm going to die here," she realized. "They're going to slaughter all of us." "Rin!" Kitai shoved her hard. She stumbled against stones as an axe embedded itself in the wall where her head had been. Its wielder jerked the axe out of the wall and swung it again toward them, but this time Rin blocked it with her sword. The impact sent adrenaline coursing through her blood. Fear was impossible to eradicate, but so was the will to survive. Rin ducked under the soldier's arm and jammed her sword up through the soft groove beneath his chin, unprotected by the helmet. She cut through fat and sinew, felt the tip of her sword pierce directly through his tongue, and move up past his nose to where his brain was. His carotid artery exploded over the length of steel. Blood wet her hand to the elbow. He jerked a little and fell toward her. "He's dead," she thought numbly. "I've killed him." For all her combat training, Rin had never thought about what it would be like to actually take someone's life. To sever an artery, not just feign doing so. To break a body so badly that all functions ceased, that the animation was stilled forever. They were taught to incapacitate at the academy. They were trained to fight against their friends. They operated within the master's strict rules, monitored closely to avoid injury. For all their talk and theory, they had not been trained to truly kill. Rin thought she might feel the life leave her victim's body. She thought she might register his death with thoughts more significant than one down 10,000 to go. She thought she'd feel something. She registered nothing. Just a temporary shock. Then the grim realization that she needed to do this again. And again. And again. She extricated her weapon from the soldier's jaw just as another swung a sword over her head. She rammed her sword up, blocked the blow, and parried, and thrust, and spilled blood again. It wasn't any easier the second time. It seemed as if the world were filled with Federation soldiers. They all looked the same. Identical helmets, identical armor. Cut one down and here comes another.
Within the melee, Rin didn't have time to think. She fought by reflex. Every action demanded a reaction. She couldn't see Kitai anymore. He had disappeared into the sea of bodies, an ocean of clashing metal and torches. Fighting the Federation was wholly different from fighting in the ring. She didn't have melee practice. The enemy came from every angle, not just one, and defeating one opponent didn't bring you any closer to winning the battle. The Federation did not have martial arts. Their movements were blocky, studied. Their patterns were predictable. But they had practice with formations, with group combat. They moved as if they had a hive mind, coordinated actions produced by years of drilling. They were better trained. They were better equipped. The Federation didn't fight a graceful fight. They fought a brutal one. And they didn't fear death. If they were hurt, they fell, and their comrades advanced over their dead bodies. They were relentless. There were so many of them. I am going to die. Unless... The poppy seeds in her pocket screamed for her to swallow them. She could take them now. She could go to the Pantheon and call a god down. What did Jiang's warnings matter, when they were all going to die regardless? She had seen the face of the Phoenix. She knew what power was at her fingertips, if only she asked. I can make you fearless. I can make you a legend. She did not want to be a legend, but she wanted to stay alive. She wanted more than anything to live. Consequences be damned. And if calling the Phoenix would do that for her, then so be it. Jiang's warning meant nothing to her now. Not while her countrymen and classmates were hacked to pieces beside her. Not while she didn't know if each second was going to be her last. If she was going to die, she would not die like this. Small, weak, and helpless. She had a link to a god. She would die a shaman. Heart hammering, she ducked behind a gated corner. For the few seconds in which nobody saw her, she jammed her hand into her pocket and dug the seeds out. She brought them to her mouth. She hesitated. If she swallowed the seeds but it didn't work, she would certainly die. She could not fight drugged, dazed, and hallucinating. A horn blasted through the air. She jerked her head up. It was a distress signal, coming from the east gate. But the south gate had no troops to spare. Everywhere was a crisis zone. They were outnumbered 3-1. If they lost half their troops to the east gate, then they may as well let the Federation stroll into the city unchecked. But Rin's squadron had been ordered to rally if they heard the distress call. She froze, uncertain, seeds uneaten in her palm. Well, she couldn't swallow them now. The drug needed time to take effect, and then she would be in limbo indefinitely while she probed her way to the Pantheon. And even if she could still her thoughts long enough to call the gods, she didn't know that they would answer. Should she stay here, hidden, and try to call a god? Or should she go to the aid of her comrades?
Go!
Her squadron leader shouted to her over the din of battle.
Go to the gate!
She ran. The south gate had been a melee, but the east gate was a slaughter zone. The Nikata soldiers were down. Rin raced toward their posts, but her hope died the closer she got. She couldn't see anyone in Nikata armor still fighting. The Federation soldiers were just pouring through the gate, completely unopposed. It was obvious now that the Federation forces had made the East Gate their main target. They had stationed 3 times as many troops there, had set up sophisticated siege weaponry outside the city walls. Trebuchets launched flaming pieces of debris into the unresponsive sentry towers. She saw Nyang slumped in a corner, crouched over a limp body in a militia uniform. As Rin passed, Nyang lifted her face, streaked with tears and blood. The body was Raban's. Rin felt as if she'd been stabbed in the gut.
No. Not Raban. No. Something slammed against her back. She whipped around. Two Federation soldiers had crept up behind her. The first raised his sword again and slashed down. She ducked around the path of his blade and lashed out with her sword. Metal met sinew. She was blinded by the blood streaming into her eyes. She couldn't see what she was cutting, only felt a great tension and then release. And then the Federation soldier was at her knees, howling in pain. She stabbed downward without thinking. The howling stopped. Then his comrade slammed his shield into her sword arm. Rin cried out and dropped her sword. The soldier kicked it away and smashed his shield at Rin's ribcage, then pulled his sword back to deliver the finishing blow while she was down. His sword arm faltered, then dropped. The soldier made a startled gurgling noise as he stared in disbelief at the blade protruding from his stomach. He fell forward and lay still. Nadja met Rin's eyes, and then wrenched his sword out of the soldier's back. With his other hand, he flung his spare weapon at her. She pulled it from the air. Her fingers closed with familiarity around the hilt. A wave of relief shot through her. She had a weapon. "Thanks," she said.
"On your left,"
he responded. Without thinking, they sank into a formation, back to back, fighting while covering each other's blind spots. They made a startlingly good team. Rin covered for Nadja's overstretched attacks. Nadja guarded Rin's lower corners. They were each intimately familiar with the other's weaknesses. Rin knew Nadja was slow to bring his guard back up after missed blows. Nadja parried from above while Rin ducked in low for close quarters attacks. It wasn't as if she could read his mind. She had simply spent so much time observing him that she knew exactly how he was going to attack. They were like a well-oiled machine. They were a spontaneously coordinated dance. They weren't two parts of a whole. Not quite. But they came close. If they hadn't spent so much time hating each other, Rin thought, they might have trained together. Backs to each other, swords at the enemy, they fought with savage desperation. They fought better than men twice their age. They drew on each other's strengths. As long as Nadja was fighting, wasn't flagging, Rin didn't feel fatigued either. Because she wasn't just fighting to keep herself alive now, she was fighting with a partner. They fought so well that they half convinced themselves they might emerge intact. The onslaught was in fact thinning.
"They're retreating,"
Nadja said in disbelief. Rin's chest flooded with hope for one short, blissful moment, until she realized that Nadja was wrong. The soldiers weren't backing away from them. They were making way for their general. The general stood a head taller than the tallest man Rin had ever seen. His limbs were like tree trunks, his armor made of enough metal to coat three smaller men. He sat astride a war horse as massive as he was, a monstrous creature, decked in steel. His face was hidden behind a metal helmet that covered all but his eyes.
"What is this?"
His voice sounded with an unnatural reverberation, as if the very ground shook when he spoke.
"Why have you stopped?"
He brought his warhorse to a halt before Rin and Nadja.
"Two puppies,"
he said, his voice low in amusement.
"Two Nakata puppies, holding an entire gate by themselves. Has Synegard fallen so low that the city must be defended by children?"
Nadja was trembling. Rin was too scared to tremble.
"Watch closely,"
the general said to his soldiers.
"This is how we deal with Nakata scum."
Rin reached out and grasped Naja's wrist. Nadja nodded curtly in response to her unspoken question. "Together?"
"Together."
The general reared his monstrous horse back and charged them. There was nothing they could do now. In that moment, Rin could only squeeze her eyes shut and wait for the end. It didn't come. A deafening clang shattered the air, the sound of metal against metal. The air itself shook with the unnatural vibration of a great force stopped in its tracks. When Rin realized she hadn't been cut in half or trampled to death, She opened her eyes.
What the fuck?
Nadja said. Jiang stood before them, his white hair hanging still in the air as if he had been struck by lightning. His feet did not touch the ground. Both his arms were flung out, blocking the tremendous force of the general's halberd with his own iron staff. The general tried to force Jiang's staff out of the way, and his arms trembled with a mighty pressure, but Jiang did not look like he was exerting any force at all. The air crackled unnaturally, like a prolonged rumble of thunder. The Federation soldiers fell back, as if they could sense an impending explosion.
"Jiang Ziya," said the general. "So you live after all."
"Do I know you?" Jiang asked. The general responded with another massive swing of his halberd. Jiang waved his staff and blocked the blow as effortlessly as if he were swatting away a fly. He dispelled the force of the blow into the air and the ground below them. The paving stones shuddered from the impact, nearly knocking Rin and Nadja off their feet.
"Call off your men."
Though Jiang spoke calmly, his voice echoed as if he had shouted. He appeared to have grown taller, not larger, but extended somehow, just as his shadow was extended against the wall behind them. No longer willowy and fidgety, Jiang seemed an entirely different person. Someone younger. Someone infinitely more powerful. Rin stared at him in awe. The man before her was not the doddering eccentric embarrassment of the academy. This man was a soldier. This man was a shaman. When Jiang spoke again, his voice contained the echo of itself. He spoke in two pitches, one normal and one far lower, as if his shadow shouted back everything he said at double the volume.
"Call off your men, or I will summon into existence things that should not be in this world."
Nadja grabbed at Rin's arm. His eyes were wide.
"Look!"
The air behind Jiang was warping, shimmering, turning darker than the night itself. Jiang's eyes had rolled up into the back of his head. He chanted loudly, singing in that unfamiliar language that Rin had heard him use only once before.
"You are sealed!"
the general bellowed. But he backed rapidly away from the void and clutched his halberd close.
"Am I now?"
Jiang spread his arms. Behind him sounded a keening wail, too high-pitched for any beast known to man. Something was coming through the darkness. Beyond the void, Rin saw silhouettes that should exist only in puppetry, outlines of beasts that belonged to story. A three-headed lion, a nine-tailed vixen, a mass of serpents tangled into one another, its multitude of heads snapping and biting in every direction.
"Rin, Nadja."
Jiang didn't turn around to look at them.
"Run."
Then Rin understood. Whatever was being summoned, Jiang couldn't control them.
"The gods will not be called willingly into battle. The gods will always demand something in return."
He was doing precisely what he had forbidden her to do. Nadja pulled Rin to her feet. Her left leg felt as if white-hot knives had been jammed into her kneecap. She cried out and staggered against him. He studied her. His eyes were wide with terror. There was no time to run. Jiang convulsed in the air before them, and then lost control altogether. The void burst outward, ripping the fabric of the world, collapsing the gated wall around them. He slammed his staff into the air. A wave of force emitted from the site of contact and exploded outward in a visible ring. For a moment, everything was still. And then the east wall came down. Rin moaned and rolled onto her side. She could barely see, barely feel. None of her senses worked. She was wrapped in a cocoon of darkness penetrated only by shards of pain. Her leg rubbed against something soft and human, and she reached for it. It was Nadja, She groaned and forced her eyes open. Najah lay slumped against her, bleeding profusely from a cut on his forehead. His eyes were closed. Rin sat up, wincing, and shook his shoulder.
Najah?
He stirred faintly. Relief washed over her.
We have to get up. Najah, come on. We have to—
A shower of debris erupted in the far corner by the gate. Something was buried there under the rubble. Something was alive. She clung to Najah's hand and watched the shifting rubble, hoping wildly it would be Jiang, that he would have survived whatever terror he had called and that he was all right, and he would be himself again, and he would save the— The hand that clawed out from beneath the rubble was bloody, massive, and heavily armored. Rin should have killed the general before he pulled himself out of the rubble. She should have taken Najah and run. She should have done something. But her limbs would not obey the commands that her brain sent. Her nerves could not register anything but that same fear and despair. She lay paralyzed on the ground, heart slamming against her ribs. The general staggered to his feet, took one lopsided step forward and then another. His helmet was gone. When he turned toward them, Rin's breath caught. Half of his face had been scraped away in the explosion, revealing an awful skeletal smile underneath peeling skin.
Nikada scum!
He snarled as he advanced. His foot caught against the limp form of one of his own soldiers. Without looking, he kicked it aside in disgust. His furious gaze remained fixed on Rin and Najah.
I will bury you!
Najah gave a low moan of terror. Rin's arms were finally responding to her commands. She tried to haul Najah up, but her own legs were weak with fear and she could not stand. The general loomed over them. He raised his halberd. Half-crazed with panic, Rin swung her sword upward in a great wild arc. Her blade clattered uselessly against the general's armored torso. The general closed his gauntleted fingers around her thin blade and wrenched it out of her hands. His fingers bent grooves into the steel. Trembling, she let go of her sword. He dragged her up by the collar and flung her at what was left of the wall. Her head cracked against stone. Her vision erupted in black, then spots of light, then a fuzzy nothing. She blinked slowly, and whatever vision was restored showed the general raising his halberd slowly over Najah's limp form. Rin opened her mouth to scream just as the general jammed the bladed tip into Najah's stomach. Najah made a high, keening noise. A second thrust silenced him. Sobbing with fear, Rin scrabbled in her pocket for the poppy seeds. She seized a handful and brought them to her mouth, choked them down just as the general noticed she was still moving.
No, you don't!
He snarled, hauling her back up by the front of her robes. He dragged her close to his face, leering down at her with his horrific half-smile.
No more of that Nikada witchcraft! Even the gods won't inhabit dead vessels!
Rin shook madly in his grasp, tears leaking down her face as she choked for air. Her head throbbed where he'd slammed it against the stone. She felt as if she were floating, swimming in darkness, whether from the poppy seeds or her head injury she didn't know. She was either dying or going to see the gods. Maybe both.
Please, she prayed. Please come to me. I'll do anything.
Then she tipped forward into the void. She was in that tunnel to the heavens again, spirited upward, hurtling at a tremendous speed to a place unknown. The edges of her vision turned black and then a familiar red, a sheet of crimson that spread across her entire field of vision like a glass lens. In her mind's eye, she saw the woman appear before her. The woman reached a hand toward her. But—
Get out of my way!
Rin screamed,
She didn't have time for a guardian. She didn't have time for warnings. She needed the gods. She needed her god. To her shock, the woman obeyed. And then she was through the barrier. She was hurtling upward again, and she was in the throne room of the gods. The Pantheon. All the plinths were empty except one. She saw it then in all of its glorious fire. A great and terrible voice echoed in her mind. It echoed throughout the universe.
I can give you the power you seek.
She struggled wildly to breathe, but the general's grip only tightened around her neck.
I can give you the strength to topple empires,
to burn your enemies until their bones are nothing but ash.
All this I will give you and more. You know the trade. You know the terms.
Anything, Rin whispered. Anything at all.
Everything.
Something like a gust of wind blew through the chamber. She thought she heard something cackling. Rin opened her eyes. She was not lightheaded anymore. She reached up and clasped the general's wrists. She was deathly weak. Her grasp should have been like a feather's touch. But the general howled. He dropped her, and when he raised his arms to strike her, she saw that both his wrists were a mottled, bubbling red. She crouched, raised her elbows over her head to form a pathetic shield. And a great sheet of flame erupted before her. The heat of it hit her in the face. The general stumbled backward.
No!
His mouth opened wide in disbelief. He looked at her like he was seeing someone else.
Not you!
Rin struggled to her feet. Flames continued to pour out before her. Flames she had no control over.
You're dead!
The general shouted.
I killed you!
She rose slowly, flames streaming from her hands, rivulets that ensconced them, gave no escape. The general howled in pain as the fire licked at his open wounds, the gaping holes on his face, all across his body.
I watched you burn! I watched you all burn!
Not me, she whispered, and opened her hands toward him. The fire billowed outward with a vengeance. She felt a tearing sensation, as if it were being ripped from her gut, from somewhere inside her. It coursed through her, not harming her, but immobilizing her. It used her as a conduit. She controlled the flame no more than the wick of a candle might. It rallied to her and enveloped her. In her mind's eye, she saw the phoenix, undulating from its plinth in the Pantheon, watching, laughing. She couldn't see the general through the flame, only a silhouette, an outline of armor collapsing and folding in on itself, a kneeling pile of something that was less a man than it was a chunk of charred flesh, carbon and metal.
Stop, she whispered. Please make it stop.
But the fire kept burning. The lump that had been the general staggered back and crumpled. A ball of flame that grew smaller and smaller and then was extinguished. Her lips were dry, cracked. When she moved them, they bled.
Please stop.
The fire roared louder and louder. She couldn't hear. She couldn't breathe through the heat. She sank to her knees. Eyes squeezed shut, grabbing her face with her hands.
I'm begging you.
In her mind's eye, she saw the phoenix recoil, as if irritated. It opened its wings in a huge, fiery expanse, and then folded them. The way to the Pantheon shut. Rin swayed and fell. Time ceased to hold meaning. There was a battle around her, and then there wasn't. Rin was enveloped in a silo of nothing,
insulated from anything that happened around her. Nothing else existed. Until it did.